Well, in history's most famous sermon, Jesus said these words. This is Matthew 5:28-29. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell, Jesus said. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. Now, why would the world's greatest teacher in history's most famous sermon use such graphic imagery? Anyone who dares to try to explain what Jesus meant, we say things like, now Jesus didn't mean what he said. Has that ever occurred to you that our attempts to explain what Jesus was really saying cause us to minimize or miss what he actually said? I mean, why did the wisest and best teacher who ever lived, why did the kindest soul who ever lived use such graphic imagery? On the other hand, in context, Jesus is talking about lust, and especially with the prevalence of pornography today, a lot of earnest men and women hear Jesus and say, well, you know, I must not be a Christian because I just can't seem to break this destructive pattern in my life. But Jesus' words do raise a question. Why this language, such graphic language? If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. Well, we've been making our way through the 12 steps in the Christian life. Yes, those 12 steps from AA and from the recovery community. Our thesis is that the church today needs to recover the wisdom it once passed on to the recovery community if the church is going to be healthy and viable today. The 12 steps work, we argue, because they channel the deep counterintuitive wisdom of Jesus. And today and next week, we come to steps 6 and 7, and my kids would want me to say 6, 7. Okay? Step 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step 7, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. There's an order, a logic to these steps. In step 4, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory. We hugged the cactus, as it were. In step 5, we fessed up. We admitted to God and to ourselves and to one other person the exact nature of our wrongs. And if you ever attempt any version of steps 4 and 5, and I hope you will, if you ever attempt any version of this, it's emotionally and spiritually exhausting. And so by the time you get to steps 6 and 7, these feel like a relief, a breeze. I mean, who wouldn't want to ask God to remove our defects? It's a common misconception that these two steps are easily completed. They're sometimes called the forgotten steps or the flyover steps. And just on the surface, you know, ready to have God remove all these defects of character? Humbly ask Him to do so? Check and check. I mean, who doesn't want God to remove all their character defects? Well, it turns out that you and I don't. There's a very famous illustration that came at the end, the last 3 minutes of a 50-minute talk. It was given about 50 years ago. Here's the story. The speaker said, if there's anybody new here tonight, and I hope there are some new people, there's one last thing that I think you need to do in order to have the miracle of recovery take place in your life. All you have to do if you're new is don't drink. Just turn your life over to God and get rid of all your old ideas. That's all we ask. That's all we ask you to do. And you can hear people laughing nervously in the background. He continues, When I heard about turning over all my old ideas, I realized that all of my old ideas was my whole game plan for living. It was my whole plan, everything, every conviction, every attitude, every prejudice, every idea I had about the world. It was like I was carrying around this 150-pound rock, but it was my rock. It was mine. I put this thing together. This was the real me. I was this rock. And I came in here, and it was like I was in this ocean of alcoholism, and AA threw me a life preserver. But I'm hanging on to that rock, and I'm not going to let that thing go. This is my rock. And they're yelling out there, drop the rock, drop the rock. No, man, I can't drop the rock. I'm hanging on to the life preserver of the boat full of AA members. They're all coming along, and I'm going under, and I keep going under. I'm hanging on to this thing, and they're going, hey, drop the rock. And I'm going under, and everybody's yelling, it's great up here. Come on over. And I said, how do I get up there? And they said, drop the rock, and you'll make it. But I don't want to drop the rock. I don't want to drop the rock. It's mine. And so finally one day, I don't know, something terrible happened because it took my attention away and I dropped it. And I was terrified. There goes my rock. And while I was looking down there, I was like a water skier. I came up out of the water and I'm going along. What the? Why did I want that rock anyway? And you know, that's why we want to hold on to those old ideas with a death grip. I'll never understand. It's one of the paradoxes of AA. And so if you're new here, I hope this happens to you. And I want to be sitting out there next year, the year after, whenever it takes place, because this is how I'll know about God even more. I want to be out there with some new person standing up here, and you've got that sparkle in your eye, and you're looking at some new guy, and you're saying, just drop the rock. It's the greatest. Now, that talk was given over 50 years ago, and the illustration became so famous, an entire book was written about it. Far as I know, it's the only book written on particular steps within the steps, but that tells you how important steps 6 and 7 are to the entire program. They might be the heart of it. The book is entitled, appropriately enough, Drop the Rock. Did you know that you too have been carrying a rock around all your life? I have. Do you know what your rock is? Well, there are different ways of putting it. Your rock is, well, it's all the stuff we carry around. It's your anger, your pain, your resentments. And the language of step 6, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Your rock is those defects of character. And we're not talking about chewing while your mouth is open. We're talking about all the ways you've turned out to be your own worst enemy. In biblical language, your rock is this whole complex of thoughts, feelings, and actions contained in one New Testament word, flesh. That word's used all over the Bible, over 400 times. But when the Apostle Paul uses this word, flesh, he's not talking about your skin. He's talking about a mindset of selfishness and self-centeredness, a lifestyle of self-reliance. The key verse is in the book of Romans, chapter 8, verse 13. For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. If you live according to your accustomed default patterns of feeling, thinking, and acting, that way leads to death. You will die, the Bible warns. But if by the Spirit, you hear that, by ourselves, we can't change ourselves, but if by the Spirit you put to death, see, that is graphic language, isn't it? I hope it reminds you of the graphic imagery that Jesus used. Because a serious illness calls for a serious treatment plan. And this malady is not just in our heads. The Bible uses the language of the deeds of the body. Okay? It's in our bones. It affects our nervous system. It's in everything we think, feel, and do. If you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live. Drop the rock, or you will drown. Or at least exhaust yourself, dog paddling your way through life. In the story, we have pity for the swimmer, don't we? I mean, just drop the rock. That's all you have to do. They know it's killing them, but they can't let it go. We have things like that, right? Things about yourself, maybe that anger. You know it's eating you up, but you just don't know how to let it go. We have our rocks. Why do we have such difficulty dropping them? I've thought about this question a lot for my own life. I'll give you three reasons. Our character defects are manifold and deeply embedded in our habitual patterns of life. Let me read that again. Our character defects are manifold and deeply embedded in our habitual patterns of life. I like how Ian Cron defines a character defect. He says it's any behavior that blocks the love of God from flowing in and through us into the world. It's any pattern of behavior that keeps us focused on self and stands in the way of our being useful to God and others. These are our misguided, often fear-based patterns of thought, feeling, and action. They undermine our relationships and they underwrite our addictions. It's all the futile strategies we've employed to meet our own deep emotional needs. And we've done this for a long time. Cron says, think of your defects more as defenses. And I like that way of putting it because it's a more compassionate way of understanding ourselves. These are our misguided attempts to meet our own core emotional needs that were often unmet in childhood. That's not by way of blaming our parents. It's just a way of understanding, why am I like the way I am? Most of my character defects began as defensive strategies that helped me survive and care for myself as a child in ways that I thought none of my caretakers would. Let me give you an example so you can see what I'm talking about. The writer Thomas Keating pointed out that every human being has these foundational needs for safety and security, belonging and acceptance, power and control. Those needs don't make us broken, they make us human. But when we don't feel safe and secure, where we lack belonging and acceptance, if we feel powerless or out of control, we will hunt for ways to secure that for ourselves, to survive. So in my case, I told you growing up, I learned early on how to garner the love and affection that I craved as a little boy. You just work hard. You're not going to outwork me. Work hard, perform, succeed. Very dutiful. Good boy. And that performance mentality gave me a sense of safety and security. And I want to tell you, I worked hard, and it served me well until it didn't. High standards easily devolve into soul-crushing perfectionism. And the need to control my environment easily devolved into trying to control the people around me. See, the problem with knowing what our rock is, maybe a better image is not just a rock, it's a bag of rocks. But, like the man said, it's my rock. It's mine. I put this thing together, and it's the real me. I was this rock. It's all your old ideas. It's your whole game plan for living. All your convictions. For safety and security, for power and control, for belonging and acceptance. See, that's the thing. They don't feel like character defects. They feel like, well, just who we are, the strategies we employ to calm our little hearts, to manage appearances, to soothe our own pain, to tell the world and to tell ourselves, you know what, I'm okay, Talking to us about our defenses is like talking to a turtle about his shell. It's so much a part of who we are, it's hard to imagine who we might be underneath. And like a shell, it's our armor. That's one reason it's so hard to let go of that rock. These defenses you've been carrying around all your life, they've protected you, and they served you well. You know what we call it? We call it our personality. Well, that's just the way I am. No, it's the way you've learned to soothe your pain and calm your fears. And I can prove that to you. Anytime you react in a way that is out of step with the life God intends for you, which is often, you can start to ask yourself, what's underneath this fear? Where's this pain coming from? As opposed to, well, what I normally do, scold myself or shame myself. There you go again. Won't you ever learn? I can tell you firsthand, you can't shame yourself into becoming who you want to be. You can't hate yourself into becoming a more loving person. Beating yourself up is about your character defects is a character defect. So, have some compassion. You know what's going on? You're human. And parts of us do what they do in order to survive. And it helped you. It helped you then, but it's killing you now. Thank God, no matter your age, you're starting to deal with it. See, we're not just talking about alcohol or pills or overworking. As we've said throughout these weeks, alcohol is not the problem. Alcohol is the symptom. In recovery, they say, I don't have an alcohol problem, I have an accepting reality problem. And here's the paradox. It's a sign you're starting to live in reality that you're starting to see your rock. That's one way to know you're starting to get healthier no matter your age. The paradox is you're feeling a little worse because you're getting a little better. Because it's frightening and it's disorienting to confront and to begin to dismantle these character defenses. That's why a lot of people don't do it. I'll just keep my armor, thank you. And you keep it your whole life and we bury you. This is what clinicians call denial. You know what denial is? It just looks like a conviction that at the precise moment, it is not in my best interest to change. It's not that we like who we are. But it's hard to imagine that life could be different. But it's my rock. It's mine. I put this together. That's why it's hard to let go. It's deeply embedded. Can I say one more thing about this? We think the more mature we become spiritually, the less character defects that we will have. The opposite is the case. I learned this from a man named Parker Palmer, who taught me the more we see, the more light we see. And he says, the closer you get to the light, the closer you get to the darkness. He was getting to this paradox of spiritual maturity, that the closer you get to God, the more aware of your defects, your defenses, your imperfections, all the ways you've blocked the love of God flowing in you and through you, and all the ways it sabotaged your relationships. See, you're getting better, but you're feeling a little needier. I need help. I need God, says a person getting healed. Thank God we don't see all of our character defects at once because it would crush us. It would immobilize us. There's an old saying, God reveals as much truth as you can live up to. Then the more of our defects we're enabled to see, the humbler and kinder, the more compassionate and less judgmental we become. Now, if that's true, and I believe it is, what does that tell you about how self-aware most Christians tend to be. If the hallmark is kinder, gentler, less judgmental, more humble. I mean, how can you drop a rock that you don't even know you've been carrying? How can you humbly ask God to take away what you can't even see? So that's one reason we don't drop the rock. Our character defects are manifold and deeply embedded in our habitual patterns of life. A second reason, insight, willpower, and sincerity are not strong enough to deliver us. Insight, willpower, and sincerity are not strong enough to deliver us from this darkness. This is a big one and explains why we in the church have such difficulty giving up our rocks. Because we have a lot of help, presumably, in identifying our character defects, confessing our sins. Oh, I know what my problem is. But insight alone is not transformational. I hate to tell you. I wish it were. See, it's easy to deceive ourselves and think the real challenge is in identifying these defects. Let me just read one more book or listen to one more sermon or podcast. But insight alone can stunt, it can even hinder transformation because it deceives us into thinking we've done what's really needed. Our capacity to rationalize is limitless. And the more you live in your head, which is most men, the more you live in your head, the more out of touch with emotions you are, the greater your self-deception tends to be. Or I can just say that a little simpler. Confession is not the same as repentance. I like to imagine a continuum of, say, 5 years. You might know in month one, week one, what some of your major character defects are. I know what my defects are. Week one. But on that continuum, it's going to take years. And you know why it's going to take years? Because you've been carrying around these patterns for decades. I really like how the writer James K. Smith put it. You can't think your way out of a problem you didn't think your way into. No 12-year-old kid said, you know, I think I'll live in constant fear of disappointing people. No little girl ever said, I choose to desperately need the approval of others. Said no child ever. But there are no hacks to the spiritual life. See, getting to know your rocks, that's just the beginning of your work. You can have all the insight in the world, but if you're not willing to do the hard daily work of, in Jesus' words, putting it to death, insight is worthless. And too often in the church, we just stay in our heads. Insight alone won't help us drop our rocks. Neither will willpower. The world's leading expert on and authority on willpower is a man named Roy Baumeister. He wrote the book on willpower. The name of his book is Willpower. His thesis is willpower is a finite resource that depletes with use. And proves we don't have nearly as much as we think we do. And stress, he says, zaps our willpower like nothing else. That is, under stress, our willpower gets depleted precisely when we're trying to exert it. That means we're losing control of our emotions in exactly the space we're trying to control them. That's why if you've ever tried to yell, now just calm down, or you say to someone you love, just stop it. Just stop drinking. Just stop worrying. Our addictions are the ways we've learned to soothe our pain. How can I let go of this, even if part of me knows it's killing me? But willpower will not help because in the moment, our chooser does not have the power to make a better choice. See, it's not that we don't want to. It's just that we can't imagine letting go of that rock. See, sometimes we think sincerity is the problem. You just don't want it enough. No. Sincerity is not our problem. We're not talking about sincerity. We're talking about ability. And this is hard for us as competent, successful people to admit that the real problem is one of ability. 500 years ago, Martin Luther wrote, "It is certain that man must utterly despair of his own ability before he is prepared to receive the grace of Christ." It is certain that man must utterly despair of his own ability. Utterly despair. I can put that another way. The grace of God is there for you to the measure you admit your need of it. But that has to start by admitting the countless ways we refuse to receive it. Or in terms of the story, it's my rock. I mean, how can you receive the grace of God while your hands are clutching to your rock? Receiving the grace of Christ puts us in touch with something that terrifies us, and that is the vulnerability of reality. I mean, that's why we have those character defects in the first place, precisely to prevent ourselves from feeling what scares us. Despairing of your own ability looks like, I need help, and I don't know how to help myself. And I want to tell you, that is a scary place to live. Open and vulnerable, like the turtle inside his shell. We prefer our armor, thank you. So we have a hard time letting go of our rock. I've given you a couple of reasons. Our character defects are manifold and deeply embedded in our patterns of life. Insight, character, insight, willpower, and sincerity are not strong enough to deliver us. And I've been touching on this third reason. We are terrified of letting go. We are terrified of letting go and resistant to trusting the care of anyone. I know you don't believe me. This rock, I put this together. I said a lot of what we call our personality. No, that's just a lifetime of accumulated defenses. It's just the way I am. I hope if there's one thing that we get from our time together, it's that you'll never use that phrase again. Because a true Christian will never again say that. Because you know that's precisely what Christ came to deliver us from. Whoever wants to save his life must lose it. Who I always thought I was. But our resistance to letting go of our rock is so strong because for many of us, our whole self-understanding, our whole game plan for living is wrapped up in that rock. For example, we all know people who have lived with a hurt so long, it's become them. If you've made a life of seeing yourself as a victim, if your self-understanding is integrally tied to blaming someone, scapegoating, you know people like this who've become so identified with their hurt, it's become who they are. How can I let go of that? We're afraid if we gave up these things about ourselves, we'd become the hole in the donut. I mean, who would I be if I weren't sarcastic and witty? Who would I be if I'm not working? We fear becoming invisible. And something we fear more than that is becoming average. I mean, we may not like who we are, but who would I be if I let go of my rock? See, just because you're ready to change, you have these accumulated automatic responses. What does the Bible call them? Deeds of the body. Deeds of the body that violate your good intentions. And when you feel threatened, they jump into action before you even have a chance to think about it. It's just your habitual way. Habitual. Habits are behaviors that we have outsourced to our bodies. And I like how John Ortberg puts it. Habits eat willpower for breakfast. Your habits are stronger than your good intentions. And they're also stronger than your insight. I hope you're starting to see the depth of our problem. See, if you want to be free, if you want to live a life of serenity, drop the rock. but we can't. All right, time's up. See you next week. You know, I wouldn't mind stopping here, because if even, and I mean this, if even one person listening to me felt in your bones what Martin Luther calls the despair of his own ability, if you'd let yourself feel as needy as we actually are, if you let yourself feel, well, that would do more for your soul than a decade of sermons. To be able to just finally break down and cry and say, you know what, I want to drop this rock, but I just can't. And I'm afraid of what would happen to me if I did. And to just raise your hand and say, I need help. And I can't deliver myself. You know who that is? That's someone who wants to be healed. Well, I've got good news and I've got bad news. The bad news is our sickness has to be acute before we will be healed. See, we're so invested in our rock, we won't even want to drop it until the pain of carrying our rock becomes greater than the fear attached to letting it go. In their book, Drop the Rock, the authors write, I believe we get active with step six when we get sick and tired of being sick. Sick and tired of the character defects of which our addiction is but a symptom. And sick and tired of their effect, not on our past, but on our present lives. You know, it just looks like a man in his 70s saying to his adult daughter, I hate the way this has affected our relationship. I hate the way this has affected our family. And I hate the way it's blocked me from loving you the way I've wanted. You know, I know you don't want to let it go. But I just know I can't do this anymore. You know, someone who says that is on the way to wholeness. And I want to tell you, it's never too late to begin. Some of you think, well, I'm actually older than 70. It is never too late to begin this new life Jesus offers us. It's not the healthy who need a doctor. But if we're going to let go and hand ourselves over to the care of a physician, it takes two things. It takes a desperate sense of our need for help, I need help, and it takes our trust in the wisdom and care of our doctor. Care and wisdom. Care without wisdom can't be trusted. I know you care about me, but can you help me? And wisdom without care, well, that can't be trusted to help you. I know you're a great doctor, but do you care about me? See, we need confidence that we have a doctor who's not only wise, but who cares about me. Where are you going to find help like that? Jesus is not named in the 12 steps. We've said over these weeks that the church needs AA and the 12 steps to be healthy. It must also be said that the 12 steps need Jesus and his church to be even more effective. I deeply believe that the good news of Jesus makes these steps even more robust and durable. So we go back to where we started. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better for you to lose one of your members than your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. And you may know the context here. Jesus is talking about one of those character defects, lust. Because that's a very common way that we self-soothe. In context, Jesus is taking the letter of the law, you should not commit adultery, and he's saying there's more to honoring the letter of it. Jesus says, anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Anyone who fixes upon, fantasizes about, exploits for self-gratification. And he says, this is not a small thing. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. In other words, take drastic measures to deal with these character defects. Be killing them or they will be killing you. We'll talk in a later sermon about new habits, new patterns of living. Steps 6 and 7, these are not one-time events. This is a lifestyle of ongoing surrender every day, a constant turning, a continual turning back. But you're not going to practice new habits until your heart becomes convinced. Drastic action is required, and I can't perform this surgery on my own. Until it hits you with devastating force, the power to change ourselves is not within ourselves. Remember, that's how the first three steps are often summarized. I can't, God can, I think I'll let him. I think I'll let him, but we're not going to let him. We're not going to turn to Jesus and ask Jesus to help us with our lust, our anger, whatever your rock is, until we trust Jesus' wisdom and Jesus' care to help us precisely in the places that we fear coming to Jesus. See, who is warning us here about adultery? And what was the foremost outlet of adultery in the ancient world? What is the oldest profession in the world? Prostitutes. And with whom did Jesus share his table, share his life, share his company? Whom did Jesus welcome before they amended their character defects? That's right. This man eats with prostitutes. I mean, what more graphic way could God in the flesh communicate to the rest of us God's willingness to be with us and for us than dining with unrepentant sex workers? I mean, if I accept them as they are, don't you think I can accept you as you are? But you know why we don't feel accepted? It is certain that man must utterly despair of his own ability before he is prepared to receive the grace of Christ. God will give you as much grace as you are willing to receive. And those prostitutes, well, they knew the grace they needed. But it was hard for the good and moral people of Jesus' day and our day to see it. So is the greatest sermon illustration of all time. Jesus not only shared his table with the prostitutes, but while he was eating, he turned and said to us, this is Matthew 21, verse 31, truly I tell you, the prostitutes are entering the kingdom of God ahead of you. And let me tell you, he means what he says. But it's when you know you can trust his care that Jesus comes near to you, not in spite of your rock, not in spite of your sickness, but precisely in those places you're most keen to hide. From Jesus, from the people you love, even from yourself. Those parts of you you're most ashamed of, Jesus is most drawn to. That's why he's called the great physician. He is wise, and he cares about you. And now that you know that you can trust Jesus, then you can begin to let go of that rock you've been clinging to. In fact, not just let it go. You say, you know what? Put this to death, this thing that's been killing me. Right hand, right eye. My accustomed ways of seeing things, my accustomed ways of doing things, right hand, right eye. That way leads to death. You'll only want to drop that rock when you're assured of a hand on the other side of letting go, saying, you can drop that rock and you can trust me. You can trust my care. I'm going to close today with one of my all-time favorite illustrations, and I'm going to go ahead and spend it on you today. It's from the Swiss physician and spiritual guide, a man named Paul Tournier. I think of this illustration often when I get afraid, which is often, because it reminds me, this is what faith feels like. Tournier compared the life of faith to a trapeze artist in a circus. The trapeze artist grasps the bar of the swing and launches out. He swings back and forth, higher and higher, until at the furthest point, he or she lets go. It's while she can't see the arms she's entrusting herself to that she must let go of the bar. It's that moment of letting go, that fear, that anxiety. Tournier says, this is what faith feels like. And it is terrifying to let go, to be midair, to drop our rocks. But then on the other side of letting go and reaching out, when you were caught, when you were received into the strong arms, I've got you. The transition will never be made unless the trapeze artist, unless the person of faith, finds the courage to let go and drop the rock. Tournier says, this is faith. And I would add, you know what the life of faith is? It means you keep doing it. Until letting go begins to feel like second nature. Because you're coming to trust the wisdom and care of the one who won't let you down. And that is Jesus. I mean, if he is drawn to the worst parts of us, you know what that gives us confidence to yield to him? Every part of us. It makes us entirely ready for God to remove all the defects of character and humbly willing to ask him to do so. Check and check. Well, that's the gospel from step 6.